Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland. I'm your hostess this evening, and we're brought to you through the good offices of PatriotFamilies.com, who, like you out there listening, and my friends in the chat room, are this beloved nation of ours. Tonight's topic, ladies and gentlemen, is educating the whole child, another progressive pipe dream. The educating the whole child mantra began to be used in relationship to our public schools about 30 years ago. The reason I thought of the topic for tonight and put it out for you is because I got an email at work that some amalgamation of something or other to do with education was looking for a young teacher to award Teacher of the Year for their efforts in educating the whole child. Well, I've been watching education and been engaged in it for almost 40 years now, and I've watched what educating the whole child has come to mean. Our public school teachers and administrators and staff are so busy educating the whole child in providing self-esteem lessons, preventing bullying, fighting childhood obesity, making sure that everyone is included, creating collaborative learning environments so children with special needs don't feel isolated, addressing sports issues, making sure that technology is right up to the minute, building new schools with radio stations and TV stations built in, and touting the benefits that everyone should go to college, that they haven't got time to teach reading, math, science, and history. My friend Bill just asked, why a young teacher? Well, basically because young teachers have been fed the progressive agenda all the way through college. Their professors have told them that when children don't bother to put forth any effort in the classroom and don't learn anything, it's always the teacher's fault. because we are educating the whole child. Unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, we cannot educate the whole child 7.5 hours a day for 9 months of the year and educate the child in anything that will give him or her the academic skills they need to enter the workforce and compete for what little job opportunities are out there. We can make our children feel so good about themselves that even when they can't read, they score highest in the free world in self-esteem and 27th in basic understanding of their own language. We've spent so much time educating the whole child that we have created a nation of young people who think somebody else owes them a living. And that what matters in life is attending a protest in New York City, defecating on police cars, engaging in sexual activity in the middle of a park while you text people on your smartphone and call everybody to join you with your laptop computer and demand that someone else pay your student loans because your major in women's studies doesn't give you a $50,000 a year job straight out of college. We have educated the whole child to the point where the whole child remains a child until they run up against the barrier that exists for all of us that says, if you don't earn it, you don't get it. Educating the whole child has turned into educating a child to remain a child. When our kids are young, we do everything for them. We have to, because they haven't developed the mental or physical skills to do many, many things on their own. We protect them. We wash their faces. We change their diapers. We teach them, help them learn how to walk. We talk with them so they develop language skills. We cook their food. We clean up their room. We paddle them when they get into dangerous situations to remind them that something big like a car in the middle of the road can hurt them. We watch over them carefully. We guard them from harm. We try to make their lives as joyful and innocent as we possibly can. This is what makes a parent, and this is what parents must do for young children. But it is not what parents or schools must do for young people who are approaching adulthood. This week in our school, we are preparing for a visit by Advanced Education. This is an accrediting agency that decides whether or not our school meets federal standards to be considered accredited and thus receive federal funding. We are all busily sprucing up the bulletin boards, polishing up the doors, cleaning up our classrooms, prominently displaying our newly decided upon mission statement, basically redding up the place so that our visitors will see us as a shining light in the educational darkness of the world. Also, our ecology club passed around, or put in all the teachers' boxes, a pledge to recycle that we were asked to sign, that we would promise to make sure we reused paper products and other charming ideas, and we could have an apple hung upon the eco tree in the front hall, which I'm sure will terribly impress Advanced Ed, because after all, they are the accrediting agency that decides whether or not we get the federal money that we as taxpayers have put into the coffers back for the schools, and we apply it to the things that the federal government says we should apply it to. It is not money that we get to put toward things that our schools necessarily need. It is money that we get with strings attached so that we must use it on things that the federal government approves of. Well, I'm something of a spoil sport. I didn't sign the ecology pledge, mainly because I am not going to recycle and reuse toilet paper, nor am I going to recycle and reuse paper plates. I don't use paper plates. I wash my dishes. Okay? I have a recycling trash bin, which accepts plastic bottles, glass bottles, cardboard, etc. And that's what I put in it. I generally do not buy bottled water because the water from my kitchen tap is just as good as the water from somebody else's kitchen tap in a fancy plastic bottle with a blue label and all the advertising that pays to sell it. I am not a worshiper of Gaia, the sentient planet. I thoroughly enjoyed the movie Avatar, but I didn't see that as an indictment of me as a greedy, horrible monster who is raping the planet Earth. I don't see my fellow Americans as greedy monsters raping the planet Earth either. I also do not believe in the New World Order or the eco-freaks who tell us that the world will be much better off if we just kill off all the humans and let the kind, sweet, innocent animals take over. Those same kind, sweet, innocent animals who quite happily eat one another in order to stay alive. We, too, are part of this planet's ecology, not its ecology in the mindset of the PETA people, of course. Human beings are evil monsters, and we need legal representation for dogs, cats, roaches, spiders, spotted owls, etc. We have to be good custodians of this wonderful planet on which we live. There's no denying that. But we also have to live, and we have to find new ways to do things. And we have done so for hundreds of years. We have engaged our brains and our creativity to make our lives absolutely paradisical in comparison to what they would have been had the clock stopped at, say, 1200 AD. The homeless man on the streets of New York lives better than the King of England did when the Magna Carta was signed in 1215. I don't believe that our technological advances have been in order to create a bucolic society of happy peasants tilling the soil, okay, which is basically what the eco-freaks would like us to be. It is just Mao Zedong's re-education camps dressed up in ecological frenzy and the worship of the sentient planet Gaia replacing the worship of God. All of this comes into educating the whole child. The fact that a club, okay, sponsored by the school for the students is basically attempting to, I guess you could say, elicit a promise that furthers the idea that human beings are an infestation on the planet and the incredible conveniences we have created are a plague on the face of Gaia. I do not intend to make promises I cannot keep. And the promises required of that pledge, I cannot and will not keep. Educating the whole child, to me, is something that parents are supposed to do, not the school. If your family, okay, believes that depriving yourself of certain modern conveniences will save the planet, then, because we live in a country that has freedom as one of its basic foundations, you go right ahead. If you decide that you want to go back to cloth diapers and wash them every single day, and you do not want to use disposable nursing bottles, you want glass that you sterilize, and that you prefer to avoid formula if at all possible, and hire a wet nurse if you can't nurse your own child, good for you. That's your decision and your right. But it is not your decision, nor is it your right, to tell me that I must do those things. And basically, attempt to coerce me into doing what I do not believe is either necessary or correct. So, in our effort to educate the whole child, we are now turning our children into ambassadors for whatever the federal government, under the guise of the Department of Education and its desire to educate the whole child, believes to be the philosophy du jour, the sentient earth that we must protect. Educating the whole child also includes making sure that we eliminate bullying. Yes, that would be wonderful. And like many progressive ideas, it sounds euphoric. And yes, we do need to do everything we can to prevent children from being bullied. But we also must recognize that no matter how hard we try, we're not going to be able to redesign humanity. And there will always be bullies. And all of the kumbaya moments and classroom discussions and sit down and hold hands until we all come to a consensus will not stop bullying. About the only way a bully gets stopped is if a bigger bully forces him to. Sometimes we have to be the bigger bully. And sometimes we have to let children stand on their own feet and fight their own battles. The current attitude toward bullying, physical bullying, is that we have a zero tolerance policy for any type of unwanted physical encounter in 99% of our public schools. So that if somebody shoves you into the door or elbows you in the line, in the lunch line, if you attempt to retaliate, you are hauled to the principal's office and given an equal, if not harder, sentence of disciplinary action. We're teaching our children that they are not permitted to defend themselves, that they must run to somebody in authority and tell them about it. Tell somebody at school and tell somebody at home. And don't raise your hands to fight back. I wonder what would have happened in 1941 if all of the young men who went to fight a war had been told that they were not supposed to fight back when somebody destroyed or attempted to destroy them, their country, and their way of life. I wonder if anybody who's involved in the anti-bullying crusade has ever thought about that. I really don't think they have, primarily because all these young teachers who are being looked at for the Teacher of the Year for educating the whole child have gone through their education with this same message, that if we all just sit down and make nice, everybody will love everybody, and we won't have to worry about it. The same philosophy that teaches it is possible to redesign humanity so that we can have utopia on Earth. again, educating the whole child is not teaching a child to use his or her skills, talents, and abilities to the best ends that he can possibly do, or giving him or her the tools with which to do that. It is indoctrinating the whole child into a philosophy that there is such a thing as a risk-free life, and that perfect safety and equal and alike mean the same things. It is the same mantra that progressives have been feeding the public in one way or another since the late 1800s. And it has never worked, and it never will. Compassion, ladies and gentlemen, is a wonderful thing. But compassion is not something that comes from federal mandates or legislation and regulation and programs in school to encourage you to feel good about yourself and feel good about everybody else, no matter what they do or how they do it. Compassion stems from the ability to empathize, to put yourself in another's place and decide whether or not you would like to be treated the way that they are treating you, or would you feel badly if you were treated the way you are treating them. That very ancient and out-of-date idea of the golden rule, do unto others as you would be done by. That would be educating the whole child, but that's not what's going on. What's going on is, as I said, an indoctrination into an ideology that over and over and over again has led to some form of eugenics. Eugenics is a wonderful idea logically when you look at it purely logically and don't take into consideration that you're talking about human beings. We use eugenics every day in the way we deal with breeding animals and crops. We seek out strains, genetic strains, that are adaptable and encourage survival. This is what Darwin was talking about with his survival of the fittest. He wasn't talking about we're descended from apes. He wasn't talking about dog eat dog. He wasn't talking about tear your brother's throat out before he eats your apple. He was describing a scientific process where genetic alterations prove their worth in the degree of increase in survival potential. If we, as a species, develop characteristics that allow us to survive and procreate more readily, okay, we expand our population and thus take over more territory, are able to continue to expand, etc. There comes a point, of course, when within any ecosystem, when if one species expands too much, the balance throws out, and that species usually dies off or is reduced by some natural means so that the balance is restored. Progressivism, the ideology that's being taught in our school, does not take into consideration the actual process of genetic adaptation and mutations or genetic traits that are survival prone and those that are not. Progressives have a kind of upside down, backwards, inside out view of human beings. Out of one side of their mouths, all human beings are precious and we must bend over backwards to be tolerant of everyone because there is no communication, there is no bad behavior, only communication we don't understand. So we must love everyone equally because everyone is equally valuable. And out of the other side of their mouth, they institute programs, regulations, laws, and institutions to make sure that those who do not further the aims of the group or society are quietly ushered out of it, so that the valuable citizen lives longer and produces more for the state. The kind of progressivism that our current administration and most of the regulations and actions that it's proposing and what's been going on in our schools for 30 years is exactly the same kind of progressivism that Adolf Hitler founded his Nazi party on. If you want to have a utopian society on this earth, and you want a society in which everyone is exactly the same, and in which everyone is perfectly obedient and perfectly concerned with the good of the whole rather than its individual parts, the only way you can get that is to redesign human beings. And the only way you can redesign human beings is to eliminate those whose genetic makeup, for whatever reason, doesn't fit with the obedient clone ant colony view of the happy utopian society. Individualism is anathema to progressives. They won't say so. They tout individuality out of, you know, every time they open their mouth. Now, we must protect individual rights. We must make sure that everybody has the right to do thus and so. We must never discriminate against anybody for any reason. We have to make everybody feel good about himself. Everybody has to have a level playing field. To quote Al Sharpton, Martin Luther King wanted equal stuff in everybody's house. Well, you can't have that if you have unrestricted production of human beings. You can't. You're going to have to redesign them. You're going to have to make sure that every baby born is perfectly healthy, amenable to instruction, equally adept at all aspects of learning, equally endowed with physical attributes, with absolutely no malfunctions, machine perfect, so that it will be a nicely fitting cog in the societal machine. Educating the whole child is the first step. When you educate the whole child in the manner that our public institutions do, you basically tell that child, aren't you glad you're you? And aren't you glad everybody else is you, too? My friend Yo says it's absolutely crazy, and she's right. It is. It presupposes godlike power to redesign the human spirit and the human heart and the human mind. And it defeats its own purpose. With a society made up of people who are identical in the way they approach life, there is no progress. Progress does not derive from clones. Progress derives from individuality. If everyone approaches life in exactly the same way and from exactly the same viewpoint and with exactly the same expectations, nobody ever has a new idea. Now, is that the utopia that you want your children and grandchildren to live in? That apparently is the utopia that the progressives in our current government and our educational institutions believe in, because that is the end result of their view and their understanding of what educating the whole child means. Anybody at all, I don't care who you pick, go out in the street and collar somebody, okay? Walk up to any human being, I don't care who they are, and ask them, right, what their favorite food is, and then ask them why. You will not get two identical answers to both questions, ever. You just won't. What the progressives in our education system want is the illusion of individuality in an identical clone-like society. Progressives are eternal 13-year-olds. Think back to when you were 13, and think about the kids you know who are 13. They're all about telling you that I'm an individual and I can dress the way I want, and I got to have those sneakers because everybody else has them. I have my right to do and say and be exactly who I am. But I can't wear that to school. Everybody will laugh at me because nobody wears that anymore. This is the progressive mindset. I'm an individual and I go my own path. But it better be the same path everybody else goes, or I'll be laughed at. I won't be part of the group. I won't have any friends. I won't be popular. It's the same kind of definition that progressives have for freedom of speech. Freedom of speech means you have all the freedom in the world to speak so long as you say what I like to hear. Freedom of speech is only for people who want to talk about progressivism. If you are a conservative, we can't give you freedom of speech because you'll say things that we don't agree with and that might rock the boat or make somebody angry or offend someone or show that you're different from somebody else in a not nice way. The whole system is totally oxymoronic. It is upside down, inside out, and backwards. It is an impossible pipeline. And this is the system that's educating our children. Or saying it is. My friend Bill in the chat room just said that there are those who follow and those who lead, and that he was taught not to be a follower. Amen. So was I. I was taught by my parents that I was an individual and that I needed to make my own choices based on my own integrity and my own observation and my own ability to think, and not to blindly do what everybody else does in order to win approval from people who had absolutely nothing to do with my future success in life. This is the flaw that brings down every socialist, Marxist, progressive regime that has ever been tried. Even China, which is busily being an economic powerhouse, couldn't do it under Mao's regime, because Mao's regime wanted everybody to be complacent, well-behaved peasants who did what they were told and produced for the good of the state. It wasn't until China permitted a small degree of entrepreneurship and accessed Hong Kong that China began to be a powerhouse. there isn't any way that our children can become what it is they're being told they should become and remain human beings. I am a very practical woman. I also care a great deal about the children I teach, about my family, my friends, my fellow citizens, and all the other human beings with whom I share this planet. But I do not expect that all those other human beings are going to agree with me about anything 100% of the time. Nor do I really want them to. Because if we all sit around agreeing with one another, we'll all be very comfortable, and pretty soon we won't have anything to eat, we won't have anything to wear, we won't be able to get from one place to another in any way other than walking, but we won't go there because we're happy and content exactly where we are, because nothing is ever any different anywhere else or from one day to another. Sometimes it is our flaws as human beings, ladies and gentlemen, that give us our greatest benefits. If we were content and comfortable and perfectly safe and had no choices and therefore no risks, we would never invent anything. We would never create anything. We would never love. Because that's a risk, and it isn't safe. Because when you love, you admit the possibility of loss and risk that you're not loved and returned. We would, in effect, become the cogs in the machine that the progressive mentality believes will bring us happiness. Instead of educating the whole child, our public education system should be educating the child in the skills that he or she will need to become a whole person and an individual. We need to be educating our children in how to read and understand what they read, how to think about what they read, how to ask questions and listen to the answers. How to look for information in as many places as they can find. We need to be teaching them mathematics and arithmetic so that when they're offered a mortgage on a $500,000 house at an adjustable rate that could go up any time, they won't make the assumption that the 1% interest rate they got today was going to last until they paid off that $500,000 house at $150 a month. They're not going to live long enough. We need to teach our children history. Real history. The history that's about people. How and why they did the things they did. What were they trying to achieve? How successful were they at achieving it? What did the invention of something do to societies? And why did it change them? What were the unintended consequences of acts of governments and rulers who thought they were doing what was good for the people they governed? Why were those unintended consequences not thought of? What was done in the past and how it turned out should be one of the first things our children understand, so they don't have to, in effect, reinvent the wheel every 15 years. We need to teach our children science, so that they understand that Darwin's survival of the fittest had absolutely nothing to do with go shoot your neighbor so you can take his car. And we need to teach them that we don't know everything, and that we are always discovering something new about the way our universe works. And that changing worldview and the adaptations we make to it are what keep us viable as a species. And that the only constant in life is change. And that those who cannot adapt generally do not survive. We need to be teaching our children civics so that they understand that a free people and a free society have rights and responsibilities, and that not understanding how your government of the people, by the people, and for the people works means that soon you will have no more rights and all the responsibilities. We need to focus on developing our children's minds in public schools. Childhood obesity, which is our first lady's, I guess you could call it, job in a sort of way, cannot be cured by adding an extra hour and a half of physical education to every school curriculum in the country. Oh yes, that's the idea that they want to push through the state legislature in Virginia. We're going to stop childhood obesity if we can just get the state legislature to pass a law mandating that every school child gets an extra hour and a half of PE every week. And make sure that we examine children's lunches to make certain that they're balanced and nutritionally correct. No, I'm sorry. The re-education of our kids in not to eat 6 burgers and 3 milkshakes 4 times a day is not the responsibility of the school system. That is the responsibility of parents. Very few 5-year-olds drive themselves to McDonald's for a Happy Meal. And when I was a kid, there weren't any Happy Meals, but if they were available, and I whined and cried and screamed and threw a tantrum because I couldn't have a meal with a toy in it, I wouldn't have gotten a meal at all. We'd have gone home, and I would have eaten a home-cooked one. Going out to eat for us was a treat, not standard operating procedure. Granted, when I was growing up, most moms were people who never worked a day in their life, like Governor Romney's wife. They just worked 24 hours a day, every day, their entire life, once they had children. They were stay-at-home moms. Oh, horrors. They sat around home and did absolutely nothing except dust, wash, clean, spank, dry tears, put on Band-Aids, change clothes, put on snowsuits, take off snowsuits, cook meals, clean the refrigerator, wash the car, plant gardens, take care of the dog, walk with the children to the school bus, walk the children to school, pick up the children from school, take them to ballet lessons, take them to Girl Scouts, serve as Girl Scout leaders, Cub Scout leaders, Boy Scout. Oh, they didn't do any work. They stayed at home all day and ate chocolates. But I grew up with the understanding that my parents had rules for our household, and I understood what those rules were, and I understood why they were there. And my parents weren't bending over backwards to be my buddies. They were quite happy to be my mother and my father, with all of the joy and all of the responsibility that entails. And they had to lay down the law in spite of my tears when there was something I wanted that we couldn't afford. And they had to lay down the law when I decided it was okay for me to go down the street to a friend's house without telling my mother I was leaving the yard and practically having her call the police because she didn't know where I was. Needless to say, it was a little difficult for me to sit down for a while after I got back home. But I never, ever put her in that position again. Because I understood that what I had done may have pleased me at the time, but it hurt my mother terribly. And it made me unsafe. And that had I asked permission, I would have been sent off with a kiss and a "have fun, honey." Because I had one of those lazy, do-nothing, stay-at-home moms. I understand in today's world, with the economy as it is, particularly now, when so many people are out of work and things are very expensive, I understand the need in a lot of families for both parents to work. I also understand that in our current society, we have become very enamored of things. And what makes us successful as breadwinners and caretakers of our children is the number of things that we can provide for them. And those things are expensive. Computers, smartphones, Nintendo DSs, Wii systems, ballet lessons, tap lessons, away trips with a football team, family vacations to Disney World or cruises or Atlantis. These are the things that will make our children happy. And our purpose in life as parents is to make our children happy. Well, that's only part of the purpose of a parent. Because the definition of happiness, okay, has changed. Happiness in our current society, for many people, means material success. The idea that someone could be in a less than middle class income and be happy is unbelievable to the vast majority of today's Americans. Happiness has dollar signs attached to it. Happiness is based on things. A nice house, a nice car, the latest electronic gadget, all the modern conveniences in your home. Technology that our school systems can provide. The bond issue to raise money to put new computer labs in, or to refurbish the athletic field, or build a new television station that the students can operate in high school. $1 million school buildings in which the dropout rate is 60%. That's happiness. It's the material things that we can provide for our kids that makes them happy. It's the material things that we provide for our kids that basically educates the whole child to remain a child. Happiness very rarely derives from things. Happiness usually comes from being or feeling that one is of value, that one is loved, that tomorrow is likely to be better than today, that the future is synonymous with hope. These things are some of the nurturing grounds of happiness. One of the happiest women I ever knew had very little in the way of material things. She had an alcoholic husband. She raised four children who were smart and healthy and did well in life and had children of their own. What little she had, she shared with anyone who had less than she did. For her children, her nieces, her nephews, she was always there with a hug and a listening ear and a smile and an overflowing sense of love that helped them find their feet and look their problems in the face and go on with their lives and learn from their bad choices to make better ones. She was the kind of woman that when you met her, the first thing you wanted to do was to reach out and embrace her, because she glowed with happiness. It didn't come from things. It came from her heart and mind and spirit. In today's society, she would have been thought of as probably manic depressive, who just never went into the depressive cycle. And somebody would be sure to suggest counseling of some sort. Because obviously she wasn't facing the darker side of herself. Because if we don't face the darker side of ourselves and let it out, we can't possibly be healthy. And if we don't have things, we can't possibly be happy. One of my favorite authors when I was growing up was Louise May Alcott, the author of Little Women. And of course, she fell out of favor in the 1960s because the principles with which she grew up and her view of what it meant to be a good person, and that one found one's joy in being connected to God and treating others with kindness and dealing fairly with other people, and that poverty was not a disgrace if it was only poverty of things, but lack of integrity was a disgrace. Those values that run through all of Louisa May Alcott's books were considered to be old-fashioned and foolish and simplistic and not worth investigating. You know, it was better to read Catcher in the Rye or Jean-Paul Sartre or Nietzsche or Marx, because they really understood the human condition and that we were all basically wallowing in sorrow and anger and resentment, and that the world was a filthy mess and we all had to be analyzed to within an inch of our lives so that we could deal with it and try to clean it up and deal with our own internal conflicts. Everybody was supposed to go see a psychiatrist and everybody had to have counseling whenever anything bad happened to them. I remember when I was suffering from some emotional upheavals, and I thought I was going crazy because I was having panic attacks. And my husband, we weren't married at the time, but I was sure that I was, you know, mentally unstable or something. And bless his heart, he said, no, I don't think so. I think there's something physical going on here. And, of course, I immediately assumed that, you know, I had a brain tumor or something. But anyhow, he was sensible and smart, which is one of the reasons that we got married, because he was a prize I didn't want to give up. He suggested that I investigate both psychological psychiatric approaches and physical ones. So, first one we did was we went to a psychiatrist who he happened to know and thought a great deal of. But the particular doctor was not in practice. He was on a sabbatical, so we saw one of his partners. And part of the visit was a preliminary interview with a psychiatric nurse practitioner or whatever, going through life events and so on and so forth. And she asked about, you know, people in my family that I'd lost and traumatic events and this, that, and the other. And I think one of them was the death of my grandmother and my mother's death and so on and so forth. And I went through those, you know, when they had happened. And she said, well, did you ever get counseling? And I said, no. And she said, you didn't? And I said, no, I didn't feel I needed counseling. And she said, well, you know, it's remarkable you're as mentally healthy as you are. And I thought to myself, oh, Lord, this is not the right route. And as it turned out, my husband was right. It was a physical situation. I had an ovarian cyst that was playing what with my hormones, and a complete hysterectomy took care of the problem, and I haven't had a panic attack since. But that viewpoint stems from that same idea that somehow or other we cannot really be happy unless we tear ourselves in little pieces and somebody else guides us to happiness, either through psychiatric treatment or more things. And this is, again, goes back to educating the whole child. Whenever there's something traumatic that happens to somebody in a school, right? The first thing anybody does, okay? Quick, we've called in counselors. Because our children are totally incapable. They're so fragile that unless we have professional counselors, they're all going to run amok or have nervous breakdowns or go home and commit suicide or something because one of the kids in 10th grade, driving drunk, wrapped himself around a tree and died. And without a counselor on hand in the high school, everybody will become mentally ill immediately. Now, granted, there are times when you have a major traumatic event that you need to talk to somebody. And you need to try to find someone who can help you understand, accept, and deal with what's happened. But this rush to counseling isn't about helping you deal with something. It's about telling you that you aren't capable of dealing with something without some vetted, approved, governmental, funded help. The number of conferences and counseling sessions that are mandatory for kids in school who have an individualized educational plan or who are quote-unquote at risk or who come from a disadvantaged background. Believe me, I know my eldest stepdaughter is a counselor in a school system in Georgia. They are always counseling somebody about something. It's the assumption that somehow or other, if we just get the right professional counselor, then all of a sudden, all of our troubles will be put in perspective and we will be healed. Without any effort on our part. We'll immediately have somebody step in and fix it for us. The idea of any human being able to go through a traumatic experience and find the strength and courage within him or herself to survive and prosper in spite of it without professional counseling is totally foreign to the progressive mentality. When my husband was diagnosed with cancer, and this was before we married, we got married the day before he started chemotherapy. All of the time he was going through radiation and chemo and surgery to have all of his teeth pulled at once, and a chemotherapy protocol that nearly killed him until they changed it to something else, and the incredible emotional ups and downs that such invasive tactics created. We didn't have counseling. We had each other. I had friends that I talked to in chat rooms. I had my sister-in-law, who always seemed to know what I needed to lift, and she'd call me out of the blue. I had my personal spiritual beliefs. I had love. And even during those times, there was still happiness. There was a happiness of knowing that there was something I could do, as little as it was, that helped augment my husband's failing strength. Not because a counselor told me to do it, but because I listened to my heart and I listened to my spirit and I loved him. I am not decrying, ladies and gentlemen, professional counseling. It's a very necessary thing for many people. And it works for many people. But it isn't magic. It isn't a happiness pill. And offering it the minute something bad happens, with the assumption, whether it's stated outright or only implied, that the individual human spirit is incapable of finding inner strength unless he has professional help, is the educating the whole child to remain a child. Living is a risk. Loving is a risk. Making a choice is a risk. Being who you are is a risk. There is no guarantee that everyone is always going to love you. There is no guarantee that everyone is always going to agree with you. There is no guarantee that everyone is always going to like what you like and despise what you despise. There is no guarantee that everyone is going to be interested in what you are interested in and drop what they're doing to further your interests instead of theirs. But that is not what our children are learning under the philosophy of educating the whole child. Our children are learning that they are incapable of educating themselves. Our founding fathers believed in education as a stepping stone to being a fully adult human being who continued to educate themselves until their dying day. Education, to our founding fathers, was not a guarantee of anything. It was an opportunity, an open door, a chance to make tomorrow better than today. This is what we need to return to in our educational system. We have got to stop educating the whole child in the progressive definition and start educating the potential adult in that child's body. Allowing that child to discover that when you don't study and you don't listen in class, you fail. Allowing that child to discover that, no, maybe I'm not really good at reading, but I am good at whatever. And that means I'm going to have to work really, really hard to improve at reading because it doesn't come easily or naturally to me. But I can do it. And I'm glad to have somebody help me build it up. Not do it for me, but help me do it on my own. That's what special education is supposed to be about. Not about, here, let me type this for you, and then all you have to do is put your name on it, and you'll get an A. And yes, I've seen somebody do that. You're not educating when you give a child a grade. What you are doing is anti-educating that child. You are non-teaching. You are babysitting. You are placating. You are putting the cookie in the dog's mouth so that he'll sit up when you command him to. How many of you out there ever watched Young Frankenstein with Gene Wilder and Marty Feldman? If you did, you'll probably remember Dr. Frankenstein's showing off of the monster to the audience at the theater and his popping the treat in the monster's mouth every time he, you know, did a soft shoe or whatever. Basically, that's the behaviorist theory of psychology. If you use positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement judiciously, you can train somebody to do what you don't want them to do and train them to react positively when you want them to do something. It's the way you train a puppy dog. Well, that's basically what our current educational system is doing. Some of you who have been regular listeners may remember my telling you about my grandson, whose temper tantrums and furniture throwing and biting and kicking people was getting him in lots of trouble at school. And the teacher's method of dealing with it was to take him aside and give him a game to play and a piece of candy until he could calm himself down and go back to work. And when my daughter told me about that, all I could see was Dr. Frankenstein and Peter Boyle in his monster suit, okay, on that stage, and Frankenstein surreptitiously stuffing a cookie in the monster's mouth when he finished the shuffle. The rationale behind those teachers' actions and methods of teaching my grandson how to behave in class was that they wanted him to know that he was loved. Well, my grandson's a smart little boy, not very likable, but smart. And he knew darn good and well that that was a great way to get a piece of candy and a chance to go play a game instead of doing something that was hard for him that he didn't want to do in the first place. So guess what? The tantrums increased. And everybody at school was shaking their heads, and then finally they expelled him. And we're just totally baffled when my daughter went through the roof. They just couldn't understand how she just didn't see that her son was incorrigible because they'd done all the right things. And he still was misbehaving in school. It's that educating the whole child again. We've got to make him feel that he's loved. Well, he may very well be loved, but he isn't liked very much when he behaves that way. And if he did that in my house, and he did a couple of times, he did not get a piece of candy. Trust me. No candy for behavior like that. And he doesn't do things like that in my house. And he knows. And with a little luck and a lot of hard work on his mother's part, He will grow up, and he'll be liked as well as loved, because the two are not the same thing. I had a student years ago, an adult student, who was a very devout Christian, and agonized over the fact that he couldn't feel love toward every person that he met, because some of them were really nasty. And I said, well, it's possible to love a person in the sense that they are a child of God and they are human like you, and still not like them very much. Quite often, we have relatives about which we feel both those things. And I'll bet you everybody out there listening in Blog Talk Radio land, and most of the folks here in the chat room, can probably think of a relative that they love, that they don't want anything bad to happen to them, and if they were ill or in trouble, they'd be right there to help. But I'd rather see them maybe once a year to wave at and not spend a lot of time in their company. This is the nature of being human. And although we can strive, and we do strive, to truly love our neighbor, as we were enjoined to do, love thy neighbor as thyself, which is a paraphrase of the Golden Rule again, do unto others as you would be done by, we're not always going to like each other. And when you tell children, educating the whole child, that everybody is always going to like them, which I heard a guidance counselor tell a student once, who happened to be autistic, this boy I worked with. It was very difficult for me to avoid running to the bathroom and throwing up, because there were times when he was not at all likable, especially when he was picking his nose and eating the result. The educating the whole child fiasco, ladies and gentlemen, is responsible for what we have in the White House right now. Because it was whole children being educated by the public education system that put it there. And it is whole children who have been educated by the current system who are occupying whatever particular place they feel like and tearing it up in the process. When you are told by a supposed educational professional that you must remember her favorite quote when dealing with special children with special needs, that there is no bad behavior, only communication we do not understand, it is a clear indictment of the inside out, upside down, let's make a perfect world by taking away everybody's ability to be an individual, except those that we're going to probably kill off because we won't let them reproduce, ideology of progressivism. It's a wonder our kids are able to tie their shoes without assistance, because they are shown day after day after day that they are incapable of independent action. Because there are absolutely no consequences for anything that mean anything to a lot of these kids. It's really, really sad, ladies and gentlemen, when I have children come into my in-school suspension room and tell me that they don't really like ISS, but they learned something and they got all of their work done. So it wasn't so bad after all. ISS is supposed to be punishment, right? And believe me, I don't baby them. I treat my students the way I would treat anybody the way I would choose to be treated. If they don't understand something, I will explain it as many ways as it takes to help them figure it out. But if they just refuse to do it, then there are consequences. They get sent out of the room. If they misbehave, they get sent out of the room. They have to earn their chance to talk freely at the end of the day by abiding by the rules, completing their work, and treating each other and themselves and me with respect. And it's a rare day when they don't get that free talk time. The fact that these kids get more that feels valuable to them from a punishment cell than they do in their regular classrooms should tell us all something. I want to ask all of you parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and friends and neighbors, adult people out there listening, to stop and think about the teachers you had. And I don't just mean the teachers in school. I mean the people who taught you how to do things. Okay? About things. Did anybody who taught you something do it by magic? Did anybody who was showing you how to do something tell you to close your eyes, stop up your ears, and they would pass their hands over your head, and then you knew how to fish? No, they didn't. So why are we sitting back and complacently assuming that public education is teaching our kids when, in effect, they're telling them that they don't have to put forth any effort if they just have, quote-unquote, special needs, and that even if they don't study and they don't listen in class, then their bad grade is because the teacher doesn't like them, and their parents should come to school and demand that the grade be changed. We all need to be aware, ladies and gentlemen, of what is happening in our public schools. We need to take part in what's going on in them. Go to PTA meetings. Go to school board meetings. Volunteer in your local schools. Talk to the kids. Ask them literally, what did you do in school today? And listen to the answer. And don't take nothing as the only response you're ever going to get. If you have to ask them, what was the best thing that happened to you today in school? That will tell you something. Tell them what was the worst thing that happened to you in school today. Or ask them. That'll tell you something. We can change it, ladies and gentlemen. We really can. If we, all of us, every single one of us, pay attention, we stand up for what we believe. We have to be able to stand up for ourselves. And we have to be able to stand up for ourselves when what we say isn't the popular line. We have to stand up to bullies, whether they're the kid in the schoolyard, or the members of Congress, or the inhabitants of the White House. We have to be aware that freedom of speech doesn't just protect popular speech. As a matter of fact, it doesn't protect popular speech at all. There's no need to protect popular speech. It protects unpopular speech. And we have to be able to accept the fact that there will be those who will call us names, who will threaten us, tell us that we're crazy when we speak what we believe. We have to be able to take that without retaliating in ways that diminish the truth of what we say. We can't stand up and say that we believe that everyone has a right to be himself and then tell somebody, well, you don't go to my church, so you don't have a right to say anything. Or you don't vote for my party, so you don't have a right to say anything. Or you don't live in my neighborhood, so you don't have a right to say anything. We have to be able to talk with one another, and we have to be able to accept the fact that 99% of progress comes from inspiration, creativity, and compromise. Sometimes we have to compromise, but we have to figure out where our line is. When does compromise become capitulation? And we have to be vigilant and watch that we don't step over that line. And we have to teach our children the same thing. We have to teach them to be honest. We have to teach them to stand on their own feet. We have to teach them that being who you are is not about copying someone you wish you were. And we have to teach them that being 13 isn't easy. And you're not going to be 13 forever. And we have to remind them that everything changes and that the future you envision for yourself at 16 is very unlikely to be the future you actually live in. And you have to be ready and educated and able to put forth effort so that you can and offer in the future that you will find. And not just daydream and plan for a future where everybody gives you everything you want. I believe we can change things, ladies and gentlemen, because we believe in something. We believe in personal integrity. We believe in personal freedom. We believe in being lifelong learners. We believe in asking questions. We believe in knowing what it is our leaders want to do. And we believe that we, the people, rule this country. And that we always will, provided that we remember that we are the nation. No one of us can do it by ourselves. But every one of us can speak what we believe. And there are more people out there who believe what we do than most of us realize. We have allowed ourselves to be cowed by political correctness and perceptions of bigotry and the desire not to offend anyone. Into not speaking truth as we see it. We have to have the courage of our convictions, the courage that will put up with ridicule and name-calling. And my friend Linda says, they're out there and growing in numbers. And she's right. More and more and more Americans are waking up to the fact that if we want to have our America, we have got to stand up for. We are this nation. We are the government. Because we put those people in power. And we, as a people, as citizens, are the only ones who can remove them from power if they exceed the limits our Constitution places upon them. We have to know our history. We have to know our Constitution. We have to know our leaders, not just by 30-second sound bites and campaign speeches, but by their actions. We have to look at what they voted for and why they did it. We have to examine every bit of their record. And we have to ask ourselves, is this the person that I want to make laws under which I have to live? I tell every one of my eighth grade students that civics is one of the most important courses they will ever take, because in another 5 to 6 years, they're going to be out there voting for people who are going to make laws that affect me. And I want them to know what they're voting for, and who they're voting for, and what the consequences of what those people want to do may be. If we do not start educating our children mentally, then we will educate the whole child into an eternal childhood of dependency and slavery. Every single one of us, as I've said before, is a teacher, ladies and gentlemen. Not so much by what we say, but by what we do. Teaching by precept is only effective if it is backed up by teaching by example. You won't get people to respect your opinions if you don't live by them. And you won't get people to listen to your words if they don't match your deeds. I'd like all of you out there listening to please come and visit us at www.patriotfamilies.com. It's a great place to meet people who care about this nation for what it has been, what it is, and what it can become. And who care about each other, not because we all think alike, but because we all think, and we ask questions, and we want to know. Visit us at www.patriotfamilies.com. That's patriotfamilies.com, all lowercase. And join us here on Blog Talk Radio every night of the week. We've got a radio show for you. On Sundays, Frank is set up with our guest host, Ron Goldman. On Mondays, Constitution Hour with the immortal Ron again. On Tuesdays, Patriot Family Chat with Bill and Hollis. On Wednesdays, Right from the Left Coast with Linda Sills at California Conservative. And here on with Crazy Mrs. Rowland, that ISS teacher, the Wicked Witch of the East, for Patriot Education every Thursday night, and on Friday for Mortgage Help, and on Saturdays for Dispelling the Illusion with Michael Magic. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being with us tonight, and thanks and much love and many hugs to all my family members there in the chat room. You all make my Thursday evenings an absolute delight. I hope to see you all next week on Blog Talk Radio for Patriot Education. And visit the Patriot Family website. Drop into our chat room. Read some of our blogs. Get to know our folks. I think you'll learn something, and I think you'll meet people that you'll enjoy. People with whom you can argue and agree and disagree and exchange ideas. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is one of the greatest freedoms man has ever been given. To share our thoughts and our feelings and to talk with one another. It's how we begin to make things better. Have a good night, everyone, and God bless.